Now, we're talking about levels. So right. we're talking about these brothers that get to a certain point, and then what stops them right there at that PGA line? What stops them?
Welcome to Out the Trap, a podcast that's all about Black folks and the game of golf. Tune in every Monday as I talk with Black folks from all walks of life who are passionate about this crazy game. His stories from the weekend golfer to the innovators of Black-owned golf companies and everyone in between. My name is Anthony McNeil, certified golf junkie and your host. Let's get ready to tee off. Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to episode number 5 of Out the Trap. Once again, it's me, your boy, Anthony McNeil, back with another fantastic guest joining me here on the podcast. This gentleman is a former professional player. He has 40 plus years in the golf industry. He's a self-published author. Name of the book is Invisible Golfers, African American PGA Tour Quest. He's also the director of player development for the African American Tour Quest program, which is a professional golf development program. We're going to jump into all of that with him here in a minute, but please help me welcome from Northern California, Mr. Jeffrey J.C. Callaway. J.C., how you doing, sir?
I'm doing fine. How you doing? Hello, everybody.
I appreciate you taking time out of your day to hop on the podcast here with me. Before we get into all the golf stuff and the book and everything, JC, can you just do me a favor? Can you just let everybody know a little bit about yourself outside of golf?
Outside of golf, I'm actually a writer. I'm a musician. I play the flute, and I also do arrangement, vocal arrangements, and I've done the CD before. And actually, one of my other passions is videography. I've been a journalist before when they had a magazine called Soul Publication, and I used to write article interviews. And then I went to school at San Jose State for a year where I was a DJ for the radio station. I got a chance to interview Bob Marley.
Oh, yeah?
Santa Cruz. Yeah, great Bob Marley. And then I went and took up communications, which was journalism, video production, film production, and also theater. So I really love entertainment because I grew up in Los Angeles, not too far from Hollywood. So I caught the entertainment bug, and I have an uncle who's a great jazz musician, and he was the one who actually taught me some techniques on the flute. So I'm actually working on some music projects right now. So I graduated from California State University, Dominguez Hills, and then I started the Hawthorne Community Television Program for the city of Hawthorne.
Okay.
In Southern California. And I did that for 4 years. And then I actually decided that I wanted to go back to my golf and play professional golf. So I have some things cooking right now on the other side of golf, but golf is right there. Actually, I was kind of in retirement from golf. And then a friend who I mentored years ago, I got him into golf, Preston Pinckney. He started his Pinckney Foundation years later, like 20 years later. And then he started the AATQ, the African American Tour Quest program. And he asked me if I would come and help him to be director of player development. And of course, I said yes. And so that kind of got me back into the golf thing. And then we actually have republished my book. The book is republished, and it's something that is still necessary to know about today.
Okay.
And so that's my background. I can go on and on. I've traveled to Africa and been to Sweden and France for the Cannes Film Festival. I just have a variety of experiences.
Did you grow up in California?
Yeah, I grew up in California. I was born in Chicago, Illinois. I grew up in Los Angeles in the mid-Wilshire area. And I love that area because it's 15 minutes from downtown, 15 minutes from the airport, 15 minutes from the beach, from Santa Monica Beach. And 15 minutes from Beverly Hills, you know, 20 minutes from the valley.
Well, like I said before,
where the action was at.
That's what's happening. Like I said before, we started recording here. I'll be out there for the first time come January. My partners and I headed up to Pebble Beach. So I know it's going to be a little chilly around that time of year. But like you said, we're headed out there for the view. And just to say that we had a chance to play Pebble Beach. So get that one off the bucket list.
You're going to love it. Just dress warm. You're from Michigan, so you know how to do that. You know, bring the hand warmers.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Keep them in the bag.
whatever it takes to keep your feet warm, because if you keep your feet warm, that'll help keep your whole body. But why am I telling you? You're from Michigan, for crying out loud. What's it get, 20 below there?
Yeah, man, it gets a little nippy up here. That's for sure.
Hey, you see me all getting frozen up and stuff thinking about it. Let me thaw out a little bit here. I was getting cold thinking about
Michigan. You got that warm blood now being out there in California. So, well, listen, JC, everybody came here to talk about some golf. So let's go ahead and get into that. First of all, let's start with the book, Invisible Golfers: African Americans PGA Tour Quest. What's the book all about for those that have not heard of it?
Well, the book is basically an investigative report on why we don't see any African Americans represented at large on the tour, virtually non-existent. Mm-hmm. And it all started when I was playing professional, and I was in my mid-30s at the time, and I was a pretty good player. You know, I was a bona fide professional, but not having the sponsorship and stuff like that made it tough. And so what happened was there were guys in Los Angeles that could really eat my hat that were really good, that were local legends.
Okay.
They had went to the qualifying school at that time a couple of times and could never make it. And I got curious about it. I said, why aren't these brothers making it on the tour? Why aren't they getting through the qualifying school process? And they're really good. And I just told myself, I said, I'm going to write a book about it. It took me 5 years to write it, self-published it. And that was actually in 1998. So the book is over 20 years old, but the information is still pertinent. Now, it has a historical context to it, just to build up to why, what happened, what the brothers had to go through, John Shippen and Charlie Sifford, Teddy Rose, and those players that a lot of us are familiar with now. Mm-hmm. But in this book, I started it actually as a protest book when I learned about the Caucasian only clause, the PGA Constitution. And my editor, who was a professor, and I had been knowing him for years, and he helped me out to keep me straight. He said, is this a protest book or is this investigative book to explain why you don't see any blacks on the tour? Because I was like, oh, yeah, the white man this and the white man that. We need to protest and picket and everybody get this, you know. And he said, is that the kind of book you want to write? And I actually had to think about it. And I said, no, I want to just basically investigate and find out why these brothers aren't making it on the tour. Mm-hmm. Is it their skills? Is it their psychology? Is it really the money? Or what are the problems? So I went about and did an investigation and found a library in Los Angeles, which was a library from the Amateur Athletic Foundation, which was part of the donation from the Olympics, 84 Olympics, I think it was, in Los Angeles, at the Coliseum in Los Angeles, and they left a sports library in that area. So I found and discovered that and just found a vast amount of information on books on golf and stuff like that. That's how I got a lot of research information. In addition, there were a lot of players that were hanging around in Los Angeles because my home course was Rancho Park.
Okay.
Charlie Sifford had won the L.A. Open. And there was another popular course at the time. It's called Western Avenue and is known as Chester Washington Golf Course right now, which is a popular course primarily where a lot of blacks hang out at and a lot of celebrity blacks go and play, and has a long history of black actors and actresses, you know, celebrities coming through there, as well as a lot of the pros. Charlie Sifford would come through, Lee Allen would come through. A lot of the pros would come through Chester Washington, a.k.a. Western Avenue. So being at Rancho wasn't that far. Well, it was kind of far, but a lot of the players would come over to Rancho too. Rancho was a popular golf course in Los Angeles. And so I had an opportunity to talk and interview a lot of the players that played back in the days and talked about what it takes to get on the tour. Black players, specifically, some of the problems that they have to go through, you know, which include a gambling issue.
Yeah.
Making the rent, not getting sponsorship, and just good old fashioned choking when they get the opportunity. But let's just be straight about that. Mm-hmm. And so there was a variety of factors that came about that I found out in talking to these old pros, as well as the pros of the days that were trying to get on the tour. Some of the difficulties that they were going through to get on the tour. And I take a quote from a friend of mine, Jeff Jones, who was a part of the PGA membership. And he said, you can't work 8 hours a day and expect to be a professional golfer, you know, play on the tour. And that was one reality that hit me. So the three factors or aspects that came about that I concluded to was it was a sociological issue, psychological issue, and a financial issue.
Okay.
Not necessarily in that order, but you can interchange them. And then we started looking at it.
Now, from the time you wrote the book up until today, do you think there's been a great deal of progress, or do you think we still got a long ways to go in terms of us being, I mean, take out Tiger, because Tiger is definitely an exception, but take Tiger out of it. And when you look at the handful that are out there now, do you think there should be a lot more Black players on the PGA Tour? Or do you think that we still got some work to do as far as our talent, or is talent even the issue as to why we can't make it to that level? Because all the other things we can overcome, because if we really wanted to get the backing, there's enough powerful Black people in this country that play golf that could put the money up if there's another Tiger out there that don't have those type of resources. But do you think that's something that is possible nowadays?
I think it's possible, and I think that a lot of the players do have the talent, but it's more than just talent now. It has to do with your intestinal fortitude and your makeup and having the, I'm going to use the word excessive amount of opportunity that's not being realized. A lot of these players go overseas and they play on European tours. They play on an Asian tour. They have a lot of experience before they even get to the PGA. I think when we speak in terms of talent, yeah, there's a lot of brothers out there with the fundamentals that have it. But taking it to the next level is more of the issue. Can we take it to the next level? Can these players take it to the next level? And then what does it take to get to the next level? We have two players out there right now that are at the Korn Ferry qualifying school, Willie Mack III and Yasha Mukasa. I may not be pronounced correctly, but we have two players that's in the Korn Ferry qualifying school. Now, we're talking about levels. So right. We're talking about these brothers that get to a certain point, and then what stops them right there at that PGA line? What stops them? Yeah. You know, we had some brothers that were in there, some African-American players that were in there, and they didn't get past that qualifier. That Korn Ferry qualifier now. And that was all around, taking place all around the United States in Alabama, Arizona, New Mexico, Florida, you name it.
Well, everybody that's played this game know how important the mental side is. And to get to that level and not make it, if that's the wall where a lot of these guys are struggling to get through at the qualifying level, if you got the talent to make it there, to that qualifier, is it the mental side where we're falling short at? Do you have an opinion of that as to what the actual problem is, why we can't overcome that hurdle if there's more of us making it into these qualifications?
It goes from player to player. We have to always remember that golf is an individual. It's not a community sport. It's not a team sport. And you don't have a lot of social support. But a few of our Black players are starting to get the program where they have a sports psychologist. Like with the AATQ program, we have a sport psychologist. We have a fitness and nutrition coach. We have me as a director for development. So we have a support system and a team for these players. But like I said, it's individual to individual. We would have to go with each individual and find out what are the three aspects of really their problem? Is there a sociological issue with them? Some players may need more support from the community than other players, because golf can be a lonely thing, and that loneliness can affect your game. Oh, I'm out here by myself.
For sure.
It'd be nice if my brother was out here. And that was kind of like me at that came to the realization. When my brother came, I had a brother that moved to Sweden. He came all the way to Sweden. He came out and watched me for 18 holes.
Okay.
And it was a dog day afternoon for me that day. But the fact that my brother was out there with me gave me a sense of pride that I got to finish up. I got to look strong and feel and act strong because my little brother's out here looking at me and watching. That brings a certain something out of you that could get you past that level. if you have that or if you don't have it, whichever way. It's like when my cousin came out, who was my mentor, my writing mentor, he came out, just watched a few holes for me. Once again, I had to make sure I was topping the ball. It was a certain kind of focus that came. And that's what I say, that sociological side of. And so when you get to the mental side, now we're really getting deep. And that's the area of the sport psychologist. I'm more of a sport, a golfer, a philosopher, a theorist. You know, I make theories and stuff. And one of my theories is the nerves. Let's get those nerves under control, guys. And when we get to the next level, what is the next level? What does it take? When you get the opportunity to qualify, brother, you got to qualify. You understand? When you get and then we look at the financial. When you get the money from somebody to go out there and play, even if it's the APGA, which is basically a developmental tour,
right?
Kind of like the minor league.
Yeah.
But is this, the fact is this, if you somebody gives you money, $15,000, $10,000, $20,000, whatever the money is, you have to go out there and perform. And you have to execute. You have to come through when you have that opportunity. Because what's going to happen is you get out there, he's no Tiger. Who's going to put their money into a guy who can't get past, I'm going to be kind of say, can't get past 68 when you're in competition and you can't shoot lower than 68.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny because I'm going to kind of make a parallel here a little bit, something that just happened a couple of weeks ago in NASCAR. And I don't know how many NASCAR fans we have listening, or if you're a NASCAR yourself, but Bubba Wallace, who's a black driver, the only black driver in NASCAR at the highest level right now. I'm a NASCAR fan. Bubba Wallace has always been a top 15 to 20 driver prior to this year when he won his first race. And the reason why I think he won that first race is because of the owner of his team, which is Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan, we all know the intensity that he has and the expectations that he has, being at everything that he's done, he's been pretty much successful with. And I remember when he first said that he was coming into the sport, that he don't pay losers, and he expected Bubba to win. And I think that having someone with that type of attitude and history and expectation pushing you, I think that was the difference for Bubba. Now, in golf, like you said, it's an individual sport. So it's up to the individual to be able to get themselves to that level, especially when you have someone backing you financially. You have to, and that's one of the things I always admired about Tiger. To watch that man when he gets in the zone, it's incredible. You just mentioned it a minute ago about nerves. I played on the Golf Channel Amateur Tour, and I know how nervous I was playing. So I can't imagine going out there talking about doing this for a living and not being able to control my nerves. And that I say all that to lead me to this question. With the AATQ, first of all, it's a phenomenal program that you guys have going on there. Have you found that having a program like that supporting these young brothers out there trying to make it on the tour, do you think that that could be their Michael Jordan in a sense, to give them that extra push now that they have access to psychologists and things like that and people such as yourself that has all of this history and knowledge? You think that could be something that could push a lot of these players to allow them to help get them over that hump now, to have that type of backing from something like the AATQ?
Yes, from the AATQ perspective, I'm going to definitely say yes. If the players are willing to go with the program as we design it and tailorize it to each player. There are a couple of players that we've had, and we've scaled it down. At first, we were really trying to get 10 players, but then we found out that we couldn't afford it at the way that we were going because it's coming under a nonprofit organization. So we have to depend on donations, of course.
Okay.
And that's one of our issues. But to answer your question, I say yes. If the players are willing to follow our program and kind of put what's not working for them aside. And that's a very important comment, I believe, as it relates to what we're doing. because some players can't see themselves. Some players can't see their weaknesses. I'm very good, excellent at looking at a player's weakness. Why? Because that's what I'm looking at. Yeah, you hit it long. You look good. You have a good iron game, but your putting's weak. Mm-hmm. Your chipping's weak. Maybe your iron is weak. Maybe you hit it long, but you hit it wrong. That's weak. I'm looking at your weakness, not trying to knock you down, but say, let's figure out what we could do to get that ball in play more. Or what can we do to get that iron shot within 20 feet, and not 40 feet where you're in 3-putt range? What can we do to hit those 10 footers when we have the opportunity? You have that 10 footer 5 or 6 times a day. Let's get 6 out of 6 and get 6 under. So right. What we were trying to do as an AA with the AATQ was fulfill the 3 aspects that I mentioned, or factors that I mentioned in my book. You know, we give them the sociological side of it, where they have a team. That's part of the social aspect. And you have a team that's going to come in, back you up. You got people that you can talk to anytime. You can practically call me almost at any time to talk about golf or problem or issue that you have. You know, you have people around you that's like a family that you may not have had at first. And then you do get a little financial help. Now, we're not giving you $20,000 for you to go out there and miss a bunch of 6-footers all day and shoot 75. Hell, I can do that. Shit, I can do that on a regular tour. You know, I'm looking at it and say, yeah, maybe I need to sign up for the program myself. You know, get to the senior version. You got a senior version? Because I can really shoot 76, you know.
I hear you.
Nah, you asked me to shoot 63. That's different. And we're asking these guys to shoot 63.
Yeah,
I'm asking them to shoot 64. I'm asking them to average. Hey, man. Can you average 66.9? Because these guys and these girls out there, these women out there on these tours from the high school level on up, it's just one girl in high school just shot 57. And you going out to a qualifier and you shooting 69. Hey, I missed it by 3 strokes. 3 strokes? That's a lot of strokes,
lot of
man.
Strokes. Yeah.
You know, how can we, with the AATQ, help you? Now the player has to be willing. So the financial side, we help them, and that's still a big issue with us because, the factors in the book, like I said, financial, sociological, and psychological, they're all connected. They're integrated.
Yeah.
So even with our program, from the sociological side of it, we're not getting any help from what I thought was a Black golfing community. Mm-hmm. We got Black golfing groups out there with separate missions and purposes, but we don't have a golfing group, like I think you kind of mentioned, that come in and say, hey, you know what? AATQ has 2 players. We got 2 players now. Let's make sure that they have plenty enough for these players to play tournament to tournament and move around, and AATQ can just administer and do what they do and see and try to help them with their program, because they got bona fide people. We're out there. You can see what we're doing. We're transparent, but we're still not getting any help from the community. That's that sociological side that I'm talking about. You have an organization that I put a lot of time in what I'm doing. 8 hours a day, I'm thinking about it. I've got books I study. I'm trying to help these brothers and figure out what they get to. Hell, I wrote the book on why they're not out there. Now I'm about to write the book on what else needs to be done today. Nothing has changed.
Yeah.
But the sociological side, the brothers don't have that help, and AATQ's not getting that help. From the psychological side, well, you have to go with the brother's self. So we have a sports psychologist, and I found out a couple of things from the players that I didn't know about, but my instinct from wisdom being around, and I'm a people's person, although I like to stay it to myself, but I'm still a people's person, and I can do a human evaluation, and I can do a golf evaluation and say, you know, this brother is lacking that, but it's not validated until I hear from our sports psychologist. They say, this brother, you got to approach him a certain way. He doesn't like it when you do this or you say that, or he likes this. And so I already kind of figured that out with the players from that psychological side. You know, we covered most of the 3 factors that I'm talking about and how it integrates and how our program is addressing these factors, sociological, financial, and psychological.
Mm-hmm.
So each individual has these psychological things, man, that they're dealing with. Each individual that I talk to and that I watch, because I tried to recruit, I think close to 10.
Okay.
And only one signed up, but we got two that I kind of went out and recruited and brought him on.
And that's what I was going to ask. How were these players selected?
These players were selected by me observing their bios and looking at their on Facebook.
Okay.
And watching them on the APGA tour and seeing what they look like and then talking to them personally and finding out what it is, what kind of help they needed and where were they at. And they sent us their bios and their information. And we got, you know, people who basically wrote about them and gave them references as their kind of character and stuff. So yeah. It was a due process that I did as a manager, as a director, as an administrator, all these things that I know how to do as a veteran that's been around the game and has been in different areas of professionalism to determine what player. And the players, when we asked them to join up as for a membership, I guess they thought they were going to get that $20,000, $10,000 ride where they could just go and do what they wanted to do. And so a lot of them just said, well, they'll pass on becoming a member. But we had one player, and we pretty much stuck with him, and he's going through some trials and tribulations, but we made a breakthrough with him as far as what the program is concerned. So once again, it's from individual to individual, and that's what makes it really tough. For anybody out there, you have to – there's no – just, okay, this is for all brothers. All brothers have this problem. No, all brothers don't have that problem. If you get one brother $20,000, what's he going to do with that $20,000? If you give another brother $20,000, what's he going to do with that $20,000?
Yeah.
Is he going to kick back and say, I got that $20,000. Now, I don't have to work as hard.
Right.
Another brother's going to say, I got that $20,000. And Anthony gave me $20,000. Then his group gave me $20,000. I'm going to have to get off my butt. I was going out and practicing at 8, 9 o'clock. I'm going to have to start getting up at sunrise and practicing to show these brothers that they're not wasting their money. Then you got the other brother. Well, you know, I got that $20,000. I can kick back, you know, eat me some pancakes and stuff and go out there at noontime and practice and hit a couple balls, you know, go and play and not do any work while practicing.
JC, I want to back up for a minute. What was your introduction to the game?
My introduction to the game was I was riding my bike to Santa Monica Beach and came back and always passed Rancho Golf Course and saw the little par three that they had. And so I came back and I seen a good friend of mine, Bubba. What was Bubba's last name? Ricky Bland. We called him Bubba. It's Bubba. Ricky Bland. We played Little League together at Queen Anne Park in Los Angeles. Look it up. And I saw him out there and he was on the putting green. I was riding by on my bike. I said, hey, that's Bubba. I stopped by and looked at him. He was practicing, playing golf and stuff. And I was like, wow, man. He said, here, try this out. Yeah, this is a cool game. And I tried out the putter, and we started talking. And then he took me, come on. And Bubba took me inside, and then we went through the clubhouse. And when you come out from the clubhouse, from the front of where the putting greens are, you walk through the clubhouse, and then here was this big driving range. And that was the first time I seen a driving range. A bunch of people were just moving around and hitting the ball. You see the ball fly up in the air, and then you look and you see this beautiful, all this greenery and trees and stuff. That was the first time I seen it. And it was just a whole, and then you see some kids. I saw some kids my age. This happened to be white kids, but you know, Bubba was black. So what they happened to be white kids, but you know, we didn't get kids. You know, I was 15 years old. We didn't care. I grew up in an area that was integrated, I have to admit, you know, and we didn't trip off white, black and all that. And you know, we didn't trip. So what happened was I was in an environment where there were other guys my age playing. So that was somebody connect. Bubba was a good friend. So we would hang out, and he was my golfing buddy. So I had a friend that introduced me to the game at 15, and I just fell in love with the game.
Well, that was my next question. What was it about the game that got you hooked? What was it that made you say, oh, this is for me?
It was fun, challenging. It was just fun and challenging. You know, it was just fun. That's all. It was outdoors.
I don't know if I can call
my
first.
And it was social. And it was social, you know.
Yeah, it was definitely that. I don't know if I could call my introduction fun. Because the first time when I got introduced to the game, I had a buddy that played. And he took me to the range with him. And that range can mess your mind up because I'm out there, I'm hitting the ball for the first time, never swung a golf club. And I'm like, okay, I'm getting it out there, 240, 250. It wasn't always straight, but it was cool. I was like, man, okay, I like this. Well, he talked me into going out on the course a couple of weeks later. Man, by the time we was done, I was like, the hell with this game. I ain't never playing this so much. I ain't touched a club again for almost 10 years.
You know, I never said the hell with this game.
Okay.
I threw some clubs. And I broke my 3-wood around a tree. I did that one time because, you know, I didn't have money to go and buy 3-woods. So I broke that 3-wood and went to use that 3-wood. So, yeah, I broke it around the tree, you know. And so I never wanted to quit. It was just fun, man. And it was like, okay, I'm going to get it this time. And okay. Slice it. Okay, I'm going to get it this time. Come out the tree, ricochet off the tree. All right. I'm going to get it this time. You know, it was always, I'm going to get it this time. I'm going to hit a good shot this time. You hit that one shot. And, ooh.
And it gets you back every time.
That's how brothers do it now. That's why brothers do all that they do and all that, you know, when they hit one good shot because they work so hard, they hit 20 bad shots to hit that one shot.
Yeah. You know? What was your professional experience like?
My professional experience was like, we were talking about nerves. I remember I was playing at what they had, the Nike Tour or the Hogan Tour, one of them tours that's now the Corn Ferry, but it went through a bunch of process. And I was out there in the tournament qualifier. And went to do a little putt. And wasn't even ready, was so nervous, the putt itself. Putter would say, I'll take too damn long. I got to putt now. Boom, putter just putted itself. I was like, damn, these nerves. Putter the cell. I wasn't ready to putter. I'm arguing with my putter. I wasn't ready to putter. Well, you take too long, man. That way you act too nervous. No, but professional experience. Well, I guess my biggest thing for me was I didn't play in a whole lot of professionals, but I liked the qualifier, and they had the LA Open qualifier, and I missed that by one. And I had a caddy out there who I had been knowing. This was years later since I had started playing. I was like in my 30s, and I had a caddy. Which is another aspect when we go rewind just real quick, when we started playing, there were a lot of older black men out there and women that was at Rancho Park that would always encourage me. Oh, yeah, go. You go, JC. Go, Jeff, or whatever. Go, JC. You know, go. All right. Right on, brother. Come on. Let's go play for a nickel and dime. And so I had one brother. His name was Lee Porter. He was a big black guy, used to be a bodyguard for the gangsters in South Central Los Angeles back in the day, back in the 50s and early 60s and stuff. He was a huge guy, man. I mean, Kai, that you definitely want in your army. You're definitely first round draft pick for a tackle. But he would take me out and he showed me how to do the gamble. Let's play for a quarter. You know, they play for that quarter, beat you in your quarter, and then just give me a quarter, man. They beat you for a dollar. They just give me a quarter, you know. But my whole thing with that is that what happened was as a pro later on, Lee ended up being my caddy. And it was one of the greatest experiences that I had to be in a qualifier with a guy who I had grown up with, a young man. And now I was this golfer who was better than him. And he was caddying for me. And it was just an awesome. We missed it by one. And you know why we missed it by one? It's because I played a break that wasn't there from 6 feet, and I missed that putt. I hit it on right there on the edge, and now I teach not all 6-footers inside the hole. If you miss it because it broke, not because you played a break that wasn't there. So that's one of my rules right now, just because I missed that. And so that was pretty much it for me. But I did learn how to get over the nerves, and I was working up to – I was a bona fide professional. So I was working and I would work. I had discipline. Yeah. I was one of those guys who would get up sunrise to sundown. You had to drag me up until I was tired and I had a lot of energy. So I would almost practice, you know, and I would practice discipline. So to answer your question, as a professional, I got pretty good at being relaxed playing out there. But my time had ran short because, you know, I shot 29 on the back nine at Riviera Country Club in North Carolina.
Okay.
And that got back to one of the members. One of the members really liked me. You know, the member said, you know, all the knowledge you have, because I was caddying at Riviera Country Club. And I was trying to play professional at the time, too. And this member hollered back, I'll never forget. We were driving around in the cart and stuff. He was paying me like $300 to drive him around the cart and talk to him. He would drink beer. And, you know, I was just caddy. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know what, all this knowledge and stuff you have, you know, if you write that down for me, And I'll pay you $2,000 for a whole little information that you're giving me right here. Man gave me $2,000. He said, here's $1,000 now. I know, don't try to go anywhere because I'll find you. You know,
right, okay, right.
You don't have to worry about that because I'm a writer and I would love to write this down for you for that other grand. And
I know that's right.
Yeah. And he gave me money for my knowledge. But then he turned around and he said, how old are you? Because I heard you shooting and you're a really great golfer and all that. I said, well, I'm 35. And then that ended that conversation, which let me know my time had ran out. Nobody's going to put money behind a 35-year-old guy who hadn't proved himself. So I said, well, maybe I'm better at something else. So I was pretty good at writing my book. And it's a classic book. People love it. It's a classic. And I have to promote it because it's a great book, even if you just have it on your bookshelf.
I'm going to put a link to it down in the show notes. So y'all make sure y'all go over and grab a copy of that book and check it out. What's that one shot that you've hit that you just always brag about to this day?
The one shot I hit that I always brag about, I don't know, I had so many good shots to brag about.
We all got that one that, you know, we kind of...
That personal one that I think about when you mentioned it was the one that I shot at El Cerrado's, and I was about 225 out from the pin, and I used the 4-iron. It was on the 18th hole, and it was a small, very small green, fell off to the left. Over to the right was like, you know, up above the hole. And that's the one I knocked within 6 feet. That was okay. My shot that I'll remember for the rest of my life. And you say, boy, you a pro. But when I went out there and I had them 7 or 8 birdies or whatever it was at Riviera, I was knocking in everything at Riviera one morning. And I was out there with the caddy. And that caddy, my caddy, Steve Hatamoto, we were rivals. And one of the other caddies came and joined us. He said, what you doing with him, Steve? He said, I ain't doing nothing with him, Callaway. JC doing. That's when I shot that 29 or 6-7 under at Riviera back now. And the greens weren't rolled or anything. It was raggedy. The dew was out there. And that's one of my proudest 9 holes ever. So that's when I said, you know, I can play professional golf because everything was coming together for me. All the sociological was there for me. Little financial was there, but not a whole lot. And the psychological was very much there, and it proved in my score.
Yeah, yeah. Well, JC, listen, before we get out of here, man, can you do me a favor? Can you let everybody know where they can go on social media or online and find you or reach out to you if they want to find more out about the AATQ or the book, everything? Where can they get all that information at?
Well, you can get the book at bookbaby.com/invisiblegolfers. You can find me at JC Callaway, and it's on Facebook, J with the small C, and then Callaway. And you can find me, JC.Callaway on Instagram, or it's Jeffrey.Callaway on Instagram. I always get Instagram mixed up on what my handle is, but it's one of the two. And you can find me at Jeffrey Callaway on Facebook. I do a lot of our content for social media content as well for the TourQuest page on Facebook. So you can find our content there. But you can find me. You know, I'm not hiding.
Well, I'll make sure we got the correct links down there in the show notes. Again, you guys go over and you guys follow Mr. Callaway and check out the AATQ and again, grab that book and check it out and see what this gentleman has going on. Invisible Golfers, African Americans PGA Tour Quest. It will be a link down in the show notes once again. Mr. Callaway, before we get out of here, sir, any last words?
Hey, I'd like to thank you for having me on your show, number one. I really appreciate it. And the last words are play good golf. Good golf is acquired. Bad golf is
indeed.
Bad golf is a gift. Good golf is acquired. Think about
indeed.
It.
On that note, folks, I'm out of here. Listen, you guys know the routine. Whatever platform you're listening to the podcast on, please subscribe, follow, whatever they ask you to do. Leave reviews with these algorithms and all that stuff. That's how we are found. We don't have a big community out there. That's why I started this podcast. So let's all come together. Let's all support one another. And let's all help each other get better at this game. On that note, you guys keep hitting them straight. And I will see you all on the next episode. I'm out of here. Bye-bye.